Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and I am here joined by two gentlemen, the owners of the Case Study House 26, Cord Struckman and Alfonso Cordon. How are you guys?
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us.
This is great. This is very fun. So I know Cord from Doko Momo. We're both on the board of this great organization for preservation. And I found out that he owns this house designed by Beverly Thorne. I'm supposed to say Beverly D. Thorne. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And we're also going to talk about how they have completely restored this house themselves. So why don't we start at the beginning, gentlemen, with arts and architecture, and maybe you can give our audience a little start, the story of this great program that the Case Study Architects were involved in.
Sure. The Case Study House program was sponsored by the magazine Arts and Architecture. I think it ran from 1945 to 1965. And the aim of the program was really, after the war had ended, to promote new ways of designing houses using new materials, using new techniques. And it had certain specifications. Mm-hmm. Some of them were that the house had to be less than 2,000 square feet. The idea, it was not designed for any family in particular, but it was designed for the ideal family, which was two parents, two children. And it was also the program probably responsible for creating open spaces, making use of indoor-outdoor, because most of the house, all of the houses were built in California, especially in Southern California, where the weather allows to have really a great indoor-outdoor lifestyle. Yes. And those were pretty much the some of the requirements of the program. It was started by John Atenza and some of the who was the editor of the magazine, and some of the best examples, at least I think, of California and probably U.S. architecture came out of the program. The first phase of the program included the Neutras, include the EMs, include those architects that are really well known. Our house, it's a little bit from the later part of the program, but certainly some of the best examples and some of the nicest also perhaps examples of architecture came from that program. Mm.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And one important detail to be part of the Case Study House program was that after completion, it was open to the public. So this was really the means to really get these new ideas, how people live with modern appliances, with different, with the open floor plan, with the indoor-outdoor living, get it out to the public. So the houses in Los Angeles had an enormous amount of people going through them, like hundreds of thousands of people. And for our case, in our case, this was the case as well. Mm-hmm. So after it was completed, then in November 62, they had an open house where it was opened and some celebrities came and they had helicopters landing on the roof. Mm. So I think this was a chance to really get the word out and really show it, not just through photographs, but really through the real example how a modern house could look like.
Yes. And Thorne was the last living Case Study architect. He did 100 homes in California and Hawaii. And I believe he was in Hawaii when you had moved in to your home. And it's a very interesting story because you did not know much. You weren't even looking for a mid-century modern home when you found it. How did that come about?
Correct. This was actually the first Case Study House that we saw. I mean, my background is architecture, so I did hear about I was aware of the Case Study House program, but also thought they are all in Southern California. So
yes.
It became available and was for sale in 2015 after the first owner passed away. So, and it was a good chance to then really see the house. And first I was more intrigued that the pictures that they took looked unusual, still looked unusual now.
Yes.
Even like 60 years after it was built. So we were just curious to really see the house and experience it firsthand. And so we went there, looked at it, and it was a gorgeous setting. It was a gorgeous house. And so we were very lucky that we were then able to purchase it from the first owner.
Hmm. And what was that experience like for you, Alfonso?
Yeah, but it's the same what Kurt said, right? I remember that it was after one of those beautiful California sunsets after it rains. So it was, the sky was very orangey, very golden. And the house, it's I think that you have been to the house, am I right?
I have not been to the house yet,
well,
no,
we have
not
to change,
yet.
We have to change that.
No.
But certainly, I mean, the sunset is a very special hour in the house, and it was really love at first sight.
And like me, other people can go and make arrangements to go through your website, which I'm very excited about. We should share that website with our listeners.
It's very
don't take a pencil. It's easy to remember. So we were lucky that we could get the domain casestudyhouse.com.
Yes.
And we just like to research the house and document it and share it with the public. So we have the casestudyhouse.com website where you see a lot of historical documents, the drawings, photographs. And we get a lot of inquiries, especially from academics from all over the world who are inquiring to really get high-resolution pictures or do some studies, which is always very nice to really share this information with them and also kind of see how they see it. So we had a lot of students writing theses about them, and they do a lot of research, more sometimes than we ever did, and they're great examples of how they perceive the house.
Wow. I think that you both are the ideal, almost a dream buyer for someone wanting to preserve selling their mid-century modern home. You are the dream stewards of this architecture. So you both did the complete restoration yourselves. You did all the work yourselves through your architecture background. How did this go? I mean, was this an absolute nightmare? Or
can we just ourselves?
No.
Makes it sound like we did with our own bare hands, which was not the case.
Yes.
But we found very talented people. And the house really, I mean, we were lucky when we purchased the house. It was in really good shape. The prior owners really never made any modifications, with the except of the kitchen that was really remodeled and it was no longer in its original shape. But other than that, most of the stuff that we have done, it's purely cosmetic and purely for heating preservations and things that need to be done. But none of the work has been really changing the plan or the design, the original design of the house.
Mm. Yeah. And most of the restoration and the renovation, they really had a functional purpose. So it was not really done from an aesthetic background that we liked a certain color or a certain faucet or doorknob. It was really all driven by the function that it was built in the 60s. So there were certain kitchen aspects like an indoor barbecue grill that maybe wasn't even never used, definitely would have never been used by us. So we changed something in the kitchen as well to really see how we can energy-wise improve the performance of the building. So, and I think we tried, of course, then to do this in the least visible or kind of impactful way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think kind of we liked the house as it was and just really made it that it can continue to serve living as a purpose, that it can serve this purpose very well.
That's right. I like when you said that you had a payback from really doing the work to bring the original back. You mentioned that you bought other pieces from different countries when they broke.
One of the things that happened is the construction techniques change, right? And especially with these old houses, sometimes the lever that you use for the toilet is no longer fabricated, or that. And in our case, there was one particular jealousy window that was not working. And when I traveled to Guatemala, they still make those parts over there. I purchased it and then I brought it back. And like that, many times we have really had to wait a long time to find a piece, or eBay searches that had taken us a long time to find the door handle or that special piece that is no longer being made.
Mm. What was the hardest part of the restoration? I know you're each going to have your own.
Living without a kitchen for like 2 months. And cooking on a camp stove and a camping grill.
And this was a fast project for us. So, no, I think really it's really hard because all the parts and pieces are quite unusual. So we have a steel kitchen. So we have single pane glass. So I think a normal contractor wouldn't be helpful with their recommendations how to really just change something. We spoke with a lot of people. I think this was maybe the most difficult thing, to really find people to speak with, how we can retrofit some glazing, how we can improve the sliding doors. And some people are able to help us, some not. And I think a good example is then the kitchen. So I think because we have a steel kitchen, which was not uncommon, but I think not common today anymore. So to have it repainted and recoated, we had to really find a body shop who helped us with it. So we were taking a door out and going from body shop, telling them we have a full kitchen that we'd like to have remodeled. And I think most reactions were a little bit kind of, they were quite confused what we are really having.
Right.
But we found one at the very end. Just took us a while.
Yes. Well, people think we're crazy here when we ask them to put in formica in the bathrooms or, you know, to keep the original. People look at you as if, you know, what's wrong with you? Aren't you living in the present time? I think that's one of the hardest things for homeowners to do. What are your favorite parts of the home?
I think that the house, the open space, really lends itself to entertain. So entertaining is something that we enjoy. Mm. Entertaining at the house is fun, and that's something that we enjoy. Lots of daylight, especially around this time where we are at the start of the summer, right? So there's a lot of daylight. I mean, the house has floor-to-ceiling windows in both sides, pretty much. So there's always light coming in, and I do think that at the end, it's really the personal memories and those things that you end up enjoying the most.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Cord?
Yeah, I agree with Alfonso. So I think the light quality is really nice. And it's really more accentuated even because the architecture is quite simple. So it's very minimal. We just have a few materials there. But we have a lot of glass, a lot of windows on all four sides. So basically every morning you wake up and go into the kitchen or bathroom, the light comes in some angle, and this really brings the buildings to life, which is always unique, more than almost the architecture steps back. And then it's all the connections that we made over the last 8 years. We have been living there at the end of 2015. So events like this that you invited us to your podcast, all these connections are quite not something that we could have envisioned, and we like this a lot.
That's beautiful. So I always look at Beverly Thorne's work as the most risky, as the most daredevil. I would call him a risk taker, building these homes cantilevered over cliffs and, you know, I mean, impossible properties to build. A friend of mine owns one of his designs here in Portola Valley, and you literally walk straight down this hill into the front door. So what are some of these features that you have learned about his work and some of his style? Yeah. Or what do you respect most about his work?
I think, as you said, he liked to build with steel more as a necessity because he really looked for difficult sites, and these are the sites that developers or other builders don't want to build on. So he really had this niche there in finding these basically really unbuildable areas, like on a rock, over a creek, etc., and was able to build a house. So with the use of steel, because you can have these really nice long spans. And this was very difficult for him, and not for him, also for contractors. So he really had a niche and was not so well known, because we even get it today, if we want to buy a piece of steel for the garden or something, people just look at us. So, and I'm sure when he asked, he needs a 60-foot beam, I'm sure you don't find many contractors who are doing it.
Right, right.
So, and I, and he was able to get it built, and even in a very aesthetic fashion. So there are other steel houses here in California, but how he used the steel, that it's even aesthetically pleasing. This is really, then it becomes really an art. Mm. And often he really worked and helped the contractor how he wants the steel mills grinded down and how the welds should look. So he was really hands-on and really showed the contractor the quality that he expected. Mm. And this made him really quite an outlier in the design and construction industry, that not many people knew him. And even all the architecture books, and there are many of California architecture books mm. with buildings after World War II, like all the Eichlers or then
right.
Turnbull and Escherich, he never shows up because he didn't really care about getting his name out. And looking back now, these are some of the most outstanding examples of Northern California architecture.
I agree. I agree. Really bold, beautiful designs. I know he gained a lot of fame after he worked on the Brubeck House and working with, you know, the famous jazz musician, David Brubeck. But you had an insight into him as a person, not wanting to just do homes for famous people, but he wanted to build, you know, really, really good works for, you know, average people. And he changed his name. Do you want to share the story about the fame and the...
And he really liked to work for friends and family. So even the Brubecks, they knew each other from a jazz club on the UC Berkeley campus. So he was really a friend. And he wasn't famous at that time when they started to, again, with the Brubecks finding a lot that was really unbuildable because it was basically a rock. So, and then he built a house for them. Brubeck became famous. And then the house became very famous because it cantilevers out like 20 feet over the rock. Quite impressive. But because it became so famous that people thought he is only building for rich and famous people. And then he feared, and maybe it also happened, that people didn't call him. Mm-hmm. So that's why he changed his name back to his kind of birth name, Beverly Thorne, from David originally, and had his phone number unlisted, mm-hmm. and then continued to build kind of under the radar screen, under the name Beverly Thorne, mm-hmm. Continued to build houses for friends and family. We have been visiting many Thorne houses because we are quite curious how his other houses look. And when we meet often the second owners now, they have stories about the first owners. And they always talk about kind of how close the relationship between architect and the client really was. That mm-hmm. he really custom designed the house for him, mm-hmm. for them, for the family. And as a fact, then they lived in those houses for a very, very long time.
That's
so
right.
Those houses are not for sale very, very often.
That's right. So you're involved with preservation. Obviously, Docomomo is important to both of you. I've seen both of you supporting and, you know, advocating for people to preserve this architecture in these homes. What does this mean to both of you? Maybe I'll start with you, Alfonso.
I think that we're very lucky to live in an architectural space like we do. And I mean, obviously we're the owners, but we consider ourselves more stewards of the house and try to preserve it for, as Kurt mentioned earlier, architects, students, and designers, right? For people who are interested in seeing this great example of 1960s architecture. So it's rewarding, right, to see people that come and from, they traveled half the world. I mean, we have a group of people that came from Danish, no,
Dutch.
Dutch, architects. Yeah, a group of Dutch architects that came to visit the house and they traveled the world to see it. I mean, people from Latin America. So it's always very worth to see the interest that the house still gets, even after 60 years.
Wow. I need cord.
Again, it's the same. So, so it's a wonderful place to live. So, and it's more than just a place to live. So it has all the history and the background there. And I think this makes it special. So I think we just like to share it. And we know something about the house and the times when the house was built. And we meet a lot of people who also know something that is very interesting to us. So.
One of the interesting things of the house is that it came from the 1960s, right? And a lot of things happened in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in California. So that has also made us more aware of what happened, stuff that is still happening today and that social issues that we still see today, right? One of the things that the program tried to do was to alleviate the housing problem that existed in the U.S. and in California after so many people were moving. And as you can see, I mean, we're here 60, 70 years later and the problem still persists. But again, I mean, living in a house like that one makes you more appreciative of architecture and creates a responsibility on you on trying to preserve it for others.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love how they look at each other as if you're speaking for each other in the same. Okay. I love that.
One thing I must say is that actually you're interviewing at the most boring owners of the house because the people who own the house before, they really were the ones that you wanted to interview.
No, I don't agree.
He was a TWA pilot in the 1960s and she was a flight attendant and certainly in an era that was not what being a pilot is today, right? But an era where being pilot was probably considered being the CEO of the company. Yes. So I'm pretty sure that they had great stories and a lot of great things to tell about the house.
Yeah. No, and we are lucky that we are in good contact with the children of the first owner. So we hear a couple of stories from them because this is so interesting that it's not that long ago, it's 40 years ago. So right. They still remember growing up there. They remember how it was living there. Even if they didn't realize at that point what a special house it is, I think they started to appreciate it more now.
Yes.
Or when they were older. And it's great to hear all these stories. So we really keep in, maybe a recommendation for other kind of house owners is it to really kind of record all the information that you can really gather, the things that have happened in the house and things that you change. So I think this is always very, very interesting to, it's more than the architecture. It's not just the wood or the steel or the sliding doors. It's really kind of how it was living in these houses. And we are still living in there too. And you can really see how this then relates to each other.
Beautiful. And you have gotten to know a lot of these other owners, and what has that experience been like, kind of bonding with these other homeowners?
Yeah,
you have a lot of
them.
They are
always surprised that
we all have the same. We all have the same complaints. So that the houses are too cold.
Yeah, yeah. No,
I think
it's too expensive to heat in the winter.
And I don't know if this is even the biggest complaint. So I think it's super interesting because then to meet them, and then we are the people who interview them. So to really, why did you buy this house? So, and I mean, now kind of the name is more a little bit better known, Beverly Thorn, especially since all the case study house books came out. But as some owners have been living since the 70s, 80s in those houses, and they made at one point the decision to buy it, and maybe all their friends ask, why do you buy a steel house? This still happened in 2015 when we bought it. So some people thought we are buying a fixer, and we were thinking, oh no, this is a really unique opportunity for us.
Yes.
And of course, we never regretted it.
I love that. And you're doing something special. You've worked a lot on this for the what would have been the 100th birthday of Beverly Thorn coming up next month. And this is going to be something special that Doko Momo is doing. You can all check it out. Everyone listening, you can go to the Doko Momo Northern California website and check this out. We don't have the exact dates yet, but we're going to be doing a tour. You know more about these homes that are involved in the tour.
Yeah, his 100th birthday would have been in the middle of July. So, and this is a great coincidence that one of his houses is for sale. So very likely we are able to do a special event at that house in the middle of July. So the, we don't know the details yet. So the best thing is to follow Docomomo Northern California or NOCA on Instagram or to go to the, our website and subscribe to the newsletter. And then you will hear more. The house for sale is a very unique space again, and we are researching it. We find again the same kind of close connection between the architect and client, how they developed the house. It's a triangular house over a creek. You couldn't build something like this again. And the client, which was a composer, musician couple, they were so grateful to Beverly Thorne that they composed an entire suite of music pieces about it. So there are a couple of short jazz pieces about the I-beam, about the triangle, and also kind of about tenacity, because I think they were quite struck how insistent Beverly Thorne was to really get these buildings permitted. Because the normal building departments, they, when someone comes with some steel drawings, they were thinking, are you building a freeway or a bridge?
Right.
So they couldn't really understand it. And we still get it too. When we have building inspections, they always ask us, where's the grounding here? You have a metal building. So we have to, he had to educate those people. And the owner of the music house, they were so grateful that they really had a whole music suite composed for him.
We
hope that we can play it during the Docomomo event at the music house in July.
It's beautiful. Well, I can't thank you both enough for doing this podcast, for sharing in our bond of preservation, and everything you've done with the house is truly amazing. I can't wait to come and visit it. And for those of you listening, remember to go to casestudyhouse.com. I can't believe they got that website. And I can't believe it was available. And we'll share the Docomomo website with you in the links on our website as well. Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.